This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 3 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
You bet, Steve. Well, we're going to not be talking about such esoteric things as astrophysics and stellar mergers as we have in the past. In fact, we're going to go in the other direction and talk about something that I think we're all very familiar with, and that's advertising. But before we get into that, well, I've got an update. And well, Steve, we've had this year a lot of delays and failures in new spacecraft that have been disappointing, but I thought we should go back in and check in on Blue Origin, and that's the company started in 2000 by Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame and fortune. Now, Blue Origin was mostly in the news for flying people, tourists actually, on suborbital missions, not unlike the very first American human flight with Commander Alan Shepard some 60 years ago. A few years back, you'll remember this, Star Trek actor Canadian William Shatner was a guest on board at the ripe old age of 90, and I thought that was kind of impressive. Blue Origin recently succeeded in sending another four tourists on a short-haul space flight, and so I guess they're getting that program on track. They don't publish a price for the seating on board, and you only get a few minutes of near-gravity experience, and then you're back on Earth faster than a 30-minute pizza delivery. People have been estimating that the cost for that, well, $600,000 US. But there is some good news update from Blue Origin. They've rolled out a much more powerful spacecraft at Cape Canaveral, and this one is named after a different astronaut, John Glenn, and it's called, not surprisingly, New Glenn. The smaller rocket they've been currently using is called New Shepard, named after the aforementioned astronaut, Alan Shepard. So the hope is that this more powerful New Glenn rocket will take flight for the first time in October of this year on a mission to carry a couple of small satellites that are bound for Mars. Now, New Glenn is a far more powerful spacecraft than the SpaceX Falcon, which we often talk about on this show, and it's just a fraction of the powerful Starship spacecraft, which is currently being perfected by SpaceX. Now, like SpaceX, Blue Origin is in it for the money, not the glory or the science. They're in it for commercial gain.
And, you know, Tim, I think I've heard that this proposal is sort of called Mars on a Budget by NASA.
That's not a bad way to sum it up here. And here's what's on offer. NASA is trying to lower the cost of science missions to Mars and elsewhere in the solar system. And the budget for this mission seems to be at just under $80 million. And Blue Origin is said to be paid about $20 million to carry the freight. Now, to make this add up to a profit, Blue Origin needs to ensure that as much of the hardware as possible can be reused. So it's a high-risk, low-budget mission, and it's one that we're going to be following pretty closely.
Now, with regards to updates, Tim, as we've mentioned before, there are so many items to choose from. It's sort of like Christmas morning. You've just opened a big double layer of Laura Secord chocolates. What to choose? And, you know, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't make mention of the two NASA astronauts carried to the ISS by the Boeing Starliner capsule. Now, by now, I'm sure that we're all aware that due to Starliner's thruster malfunctions and helium leaks, Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore will return to Earth not until February 2025 aboard a rival SpaceX Dragon capsule. But before we go too much further on this update, let's listen to someone who knows all about testing new aerospace hardware, and that's Canada's Commander Chris Hadfield. Let's have a listen.
Well, it's the very first flight of this spaceship with people on board. So it's like the very first time the space shuttle flew, or, you know, the very first time an F-18 flew. So it's an extremely dangerous flight. And they set a bunch of objectives, and the absolute minimum they thought they could maybe get done in 8 days. But when they found some other problems, which is pretty normal on a first flight of anything, they extended. But fortunately, the vehicle got them safely to the space station. And so they can stay up there for months and months and work on the problem and make sure they got everything sorted out to optimize their chances before they come home. So it's actually a pretty lucky and good set of circumstances. And, you know, Butch and Sonny are up there working and integrated and getting ready and talking to the ground every day. And they'll come home as soon as it's time.
This whole affair is both highly embarrassing to Boeing, which is concurrently plagued with aircraft issues, and it also poses a logistical accommodation problem. Now, since the Dragon capsule can hold only 4 astronauts, NASA was forced to announce it will cut 2 astronauts from the next crew headed to the ISS to make room on the return flight for Williams and Wilmore.
It's like a carpool problem. I mean, is there room for one more? I guess not. I think you've got another update for us before we get to our main topic of advertising in space, though. What is it, Steve?
Well, Tim, my second update goes all the way back to 1964 when I read an Arthur C. Clarke science fiction novella entitled Sunjammer, which was later renamed in 1972 as The Wind from the Sun. Now, this story features solar sail spaceship races to the moon propelled by the pressure of sunlight on large reflective sails.
So Clark obviously borrowed heavily on the America's Cup sailing competition, where yachts backed by billionaires sail against each other. How is NASA's space version of this different, Steve?
Well, on April 24th of this year, the Rocket Lab company launched NASA's version of a solar sail-powered spacecraft, initially called Sunjammer, in honor of Clark's novel, but it too was renamed, and it's a mouthful. This time they renamed it as the Advanced Composite Solar Sail System. And it was launched by Rocket Lab's Electron rocket. And just as a sailboat is powered by the wind in a sail, solar sails employ the pressure of sunlight for propulsion, and that eliminates the need for conventional rocket propellant. Though, interestingly, photons don't have mass. Their energy can impart momentum when they interact with an object such as a solar sail.
It's really incredible stuff, you know, solar sails in space. Steve, here's a bit of a neat segue to today's topic that I've come up with, and it regards John Fogerty, the musician. You might recall a very long time ago, he wrote a song called, quote, I Saw It on TV. And in that song, there's a line referencing the great U.S. president, John F. Kennedy, and his push to travel to the moon. Here's that line. Set sail the new frontier. And of course, it was Kennedy that had called space travel the new frontier. And the punchline on that song, quote, I know it's true, oh so true, because I saw it on TV, end quote. And of course, what powers TV? Well, advertising.
And you know, Tim, speaking of those of a certain age, we both remember televised hockey games where the boards were a pristine white. Well, that is, except for scuff marks created by pucks and the occasional body part. But then hockey began to allow advertising not only on player equipment, but on the boards and the ice as well. Now fans are bombarded by electronic board commercials tailored to the cable viewing audience.
Not only that, Steve, those ads change a couple of times a period, and some are animated, which I find visually distracting, you might say. Well, now that we've got the attention of our listeners, they just might be wondering what kind of advertising can possibly be going on in space. Let's have a go. Commercialism has recently gone to the moon when manufacturers of the Japanese sports drink Pocari Sweat began an ambitious advertising program in 2014 to send a dream capsule of its product to the moon. The capsule was made in the same shape as the can, Pocari Sweat can, and filled with its patented power, and was intended to be the first commercial product advertised on the moon. It took 10 full years for the ambitious advertisement to come to fruition, but finally this year, in January of 2024, the Pocari Sweat Dream can was launched by the astrobotic technology lunar lander called Peregrine. Unfortunately, that mission failed to reach the moon, but not before transmitting space pictures of the can zipping through space. Drink our product, and you too can feel the pep it gives you.
Tim, you said that with such conviction, I feel like going out and buying a can. And that's a pretty recent example of rent this space, shall we say. But let's have a little chronological review of space advertising. As mentioned previously, launch booster rockets were initially designed as intercontinental ballistic missiles, and they merely replaced warheads with satellites. The Soviet Union was first in designing an operational ICBM booster, and a variant called the Vostok 1 took Yuri Gagarin into space in 1961. Now, that booster didn't have a great big Soviet red star, nor hammer and sickle. No, it simply had the word Vostok printed on the first stage and CCCP on the capsule.
You know, interestingly, Gagarin's helmet was originally pure white. And it was just a day before launch that somebody recalled the trouble that foreign spy plane pilots faced when they were shot down over Soviet territory. And so to guard against a hostile welcome, should Gagarin land in a Western country, well, the initials CCCP, which means USSR in English, were quickly painted on his helmet. And all that's to say that in the very earliest days of spaceflight in the 1960s, spaceflight was all about national prestige or propaganda, actually, depending on which side of the Iron Curtain you were seated. There was no room at that point for commercial advertising in space.
Not only that, Tim, the thing about space advertising is that outer space is not ruled by any one entity per se. As previously mentioned in our series, the 1967 United Nations Outer Space Treaty essentially declared space exploration and use shall be for the benefit of all mankind. And nothing in outer space shall be claimed by any one country. And the moon and other celestial bodies shall be used exclusively for peaceful purposes.
Sounds good. And that was a treaty that was initially signed by a few countries, including Canada, the USSR, the UK, US, and well, a bunch of other countries too. Now, from a narrow legalistic point of view, there's nothing which specifically mentions advertising. So I guess in theory, a great big, well, what can I say, Eat at Mel's Diner sign could be erected on the moon, glowing its message to planet Earth. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I thought that too, Tim, but I did come across an article prohibiting American marketers from placing, quote, obtrusive advertising in space. And that's defined as being anything that can be viewed from Earth without the aid of a telescope. Russia is laxer about the issue of space advertising and has a history of selling ad space on cosmonaut spacesuits, sort of like NHL hockey players with helmets embossed with TD logos and the such.
But I think to really examine advertising in space, we would be best reminded of Billy Joel's song. I don't know if you remember, We Didn't Start the Fire, when he sings out five prominent words. Here they are: rock and roller, cola wars. Though Pepsi and Coca-Cola had been decades-long rivals for market share, it was Coca-Cola which first approached NASA about testing a soda dispenser aboard the space shuttle. Now, given the way that liquids behave in microgravity during low Earth orbit, off-the-shelf soda cans or bottles, they just won't work. So they needed a mechanism or a force to push the soda out of the container. Coca-Cola invested about $250,000 to adapt what looked like one of its aluminum cans to hold a laminated plastic bag filled with soda and a carbon dioxide pressurized bladder in it to force out the beverage.
When Pepsi got word that Coke was going into space, it immediately appealed to NASA to be included on the same mission. And NASA acquiesced, but only if Pepsi could develop a dispenser by launch time, which was July 19th, 1985, aboard STF-51F. Pepsi spent $14 million modifying an existing design, which is similar to dispensers which you can buy off the shelf, which spray out cheese whiz or whipped cream. And NASA sought to downplay the commercial aspect of this payload by referring to the Coke and Pepsi cans as, now get this, quote, carbonated beverage container evaluations. and the STS-51F crew held the results of the COLA evaluation private until their first post-flight press conference, which took place on August 14, 1985. And in that conference, when it was revealed that the Coke can was opened moments before the Pepsi can, Coca-Cola proudly declared, quote, "Coca-Cola, the first choice in refreshment around the world, is now the first soft drink tasted in space."
Picture the excitement in the room, can't you? And unfortunately, though, the advertising team at Coca-Cola had not kept up with the science of space. Now, it turns out the carbonation in the beverage doesn't leave the beverage in microgravity. You drink the pop and endure the discomfort of a bloated intestine. Steve, I don't think we'll be seeing an ad where they say 9 out of 10 astronauts prefer Coca-Cola on their space flight. So the space cola wars did continue, although Pepsi's space can didn't fly again. The company did launch, however, an oversized inflatable can to film a commercial aboard the Russian space station Mir in 1996. How about Coke? Well, Coke continued to refine its space can with a choice of different Coca-Cola carbonated beverages on STS-63 in 1995, STS-77 in 1996, and since then, Coca-Cola, well, it's remained on Earth. So we've had Coke in space. How about its partner, Steve? What about pizza?
Well, Coke and pizza, what could go wrong? So in 2001, Pizza Hut had its logo put on a Russian Proton rocket booster. And that same year, Pizza Hut delivered a pie to the International Space Station in a vacuum-sealed container aboard another Russian rocket. For economics of scale, Pizza Hut paid Roscosmos $1 million for the delivery privilege, and that was a bargain, as it's estimated the stunt garnered $250 million worth of free press for Pizza Hut. But not only has pizza and Coke gone into space, but there have been a host of other product advertisements as well. Now, Tim, similar to our Space Talks radio signals indirectly beaming into space, which have now traveled over 3 light years in distance, Tim, tell us about some directed advertising signals sent from Earth to outer space.
Back in 2008, the people at Doritos said, "We need to get into the business of beaming a commercial out to potential customers, extraterrestrial life, you might say." The commercial was part of the Doritos Broadcast Project, which invited people in the UK to create a 30-second video clip that offered a snapshot of life on Earth. The public was also allowed to vote on the best entry and chose a stop-action video called Tribe, which was then pulsed out over a 6-hour period from a high-powered radar located within the Arctic Circle. The signal was directed at a solar system 42 light-years from Earth, which may also host a habitable Goldilocks zone that could harbor small life-supporting planets like Earth. The head of the Doritos Broadcast Project said he wouldn't be too surprised if the first aliens visiting Earth immediately asked for a bag of Doritos. I don't know about that, Steve, but I viewed the Tribe on YouTube and don't think the message is all that clear. But as we like to say on Space Talks, wait, there's more. So, Steve, tell us about that.
Well, Tim, with regard to product placement, in 1990, the Tokyo Broadcasting System paid approximately $11 million to Roscosmos to fly one of its journalists to the Mir space station, and their broadcasting system logo was emblazoned on the booster's side. In 1996, Pepsi, still in the game, paid Roscosmos $5 million to have a cosmonaut float a replica Pepsi can outside the Mir space station. And the next year, 1997, the Israeli milk company Tanuva filmed a commercial for their product on Mir, and it holds the Guinness World Record for becoming the first actual advertisement filmed in space. In 2005, Nissin Foods sent vacuum-sealed cup noodles to space, which were consumed by cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev for a TV commercial.
Canada joined the race in 2006 when Russian cosmonaut Mikhail Tyrian hit a golf ball from the ISS porch as part of a commercial with the Element 21 company.
Element 21, Tim, that's a new one to me. Whatever is the Element 21 company.
Stand by. Element 21 is a Toronto-based golf and fishing equipment manufacturing company and takes its name from scandium, which is the 21st element of the periodic table. The company, well, it claims that their use of scandium alloys improves the performance of their products over other metals.
Now I'm that much wiser than I was a moment ago. Thank you, Tim. And in 2009, Toshiba, now get this, Toshiba used helium balloons to lift four empty chairs to the edge of space and filmed a TV commercial for their Regza high-definition TVs.
Here's something we've previously mentioned, Steve, and that's 3D printing. In 2016, Lowe's, the home improvement company, they teamed up with, quote, Made in Space, the company behind the world's first zero-G 3D printer, to launch the world's first commercial manufacturing facility to the ISS, to the International Space Station, called the, quote, Additive Manufacturing Facility, unquote. This 3D printer is for use by NASA, its station partners, researchers, educational organizations, and commercial customers. And at the time, Lowe's executive director had this to say, "It's the first hardware store in space. Lowe's sells tools on Earth, and this way we're going to be able to provide tools in space as well."
Who could forget SpaceX's dramatic 2018 launch of a red Tesla Roadster convertible, complete with a dummy astronaut at the wheel aboard the first Falcon Heavy test flight? And where's that car now? It's in the asteroid belt, and it will remain in a stable orbit for, wait for it, billions of years.
Billions and billions, like the number of stars. Now, with regard to advertising on the moon, there's a Japanese company called iSpace that wants to put advertising on the moon. Well, of course, why not? Again, is it legal to advertise on the moon? Well, the short answer seems to be yes. We've talked about that space treaty, the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which Japan also signed, by the way. It does not directly specify or restrict advertising. And as for the no obtrusive ads, that's the thing that the American companies are limited to. Well, it doesn't apply to other countries. So consequently, iSpace wants to project the image of an ad onto a lunar lander, rover, or some other vehicle. And while those ads wouldn't be visible from Earth, they would essentially become a photo app for brands who want the lunar landscape as a backdrop for their own logos.
And in a somewhat similar vein, I understand that a UK company called Loon Ads, that's LUN-ADS, has a similar idea by offering a non-obstructive, repeatable, and perpetual advertising method designed to bring ads from space to devices on Earth. Now, these projected images don't touch or alter the lunar surface in any way and can't be viewed by Earth directly, and therefore LoonAds doesn't contravene any laws. And the company has been awarded a patent and a trademark. And by the way, Tim, we both watched the new 2024 science fiction movie entitled Spaceman, starring Adam Sandler in a serious role for once. Now, in an otherwise forgettable film, there is one scene where before Sandler is about to perform a disinfecting procedure, he's obligated to recite a commercial from one of the mission's sponsors. And I wonder how close to reality this is about to become.
These future high-tech commercials might provide lucrative to their advertiser, but let's not forget the national pride that Canada received and continues to receive through product placement, shall we say, of the word Canada on our flag strategically placed on the Canada arms of both the space shuttle and now the ISS. Clever beyond words. So what we've been talking about today kind of ties in with one of our most recent episodes. And in that one, we were talking about Big Pharma going to space, looking at the opportunities to manufacture new pharmaceuticals or existing pharmaceuticals and turn space business into profitable business. Today, we're talking about another facet of commercialization, and that's how you can use the space opportunities for commercials to promote brands, product placement, and other sort of outrageous claims about delivering pizza to space. It's another way of saying, Steve, that we're entering this new phase of the commercialization of space.
Well, Tim and listeners, today we hope that you've gained some insight into that growing industry of space commercialism in this last half hour, Space Talks, because we surely have.
Small wonder, Steve, that with tongue in cheek, squarely in cheek, we call this episode Rent This Space. And so until next time, this is Tim Woods.
Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?